Mindfulness of feeling tone as it applies to difficult emotions, namely fear and its corollary anxiety, sadness and grief and their corollaries depression, anger and its whole host of children, you know, resentment, irritation, all the way to rage and hate, and disgust. And these are normal, natural emotions. All mammals have them. We all have. There's recent research about emotions that I think is really fascinating. We all have three basic types of emotions. The threat system, which alerts us and gets us to take some action about anything that where we need some protection, some kind of threat to the system. So those are the ones I just mentioned: anger, sadness, fear, and disgust. Then there's the drive system, which we all evolved, and not just mammals, but all animals evolved all of these. We evolved, the drive system is our acquiring of resources, and we need both those to survive. But then there's a third one, and that's the soothe system, and all animals need to restore and rest. So soothe includes, of course, rest and digest, but then mammals also developed the tend and befriend aspect of the soothe system. And all the emotions related to the soothe system are positive. Contentment, a sense of safety and ease, peace, which in Buddhism is considered the highest form of happiness, connection, creativity, communication, those aren't emotions, but they're qualities within the soothe system. And most mammals, there's some trigger that activates the threat system or the drive system and motivates them to act. They act like a zebra sees a lion. Its fear is activated. It runs. And once it's gotten away from the lion and there's no more lion in sight, it returns immediately or within a short time to the soothe system and starts eating again or hanging out with its buddies or whatever. Us humans did, so that whole system evolved over hundreds of millions of years. In the last 2 million years, as the Homo sapiens evolved, we developed this new brain that does all these incredible magical things. As we know, it can imagine, it can remember, it can plan, it can make associations, it can make visual images, and it's created everything in the human realm, this new brain. And it's intimately connected to our old mammalian brain, and the glitch in the system is that if we are tantamount to a zebra and something unpleasant happens, you know, say back when I was 12 years old, some scary thing happens, just for example, I could spend decades thinking about that thing and reactivating my fear system. And we do that. And it's how we sort of stay in places of the threat system and also the drive system, in the way that we can obsess over pleasant phenomena and come back to it again and again in an addictive or over-acquiring way. So when the Buddha was talking about greed, hatred, and delusion as the sources of reactive stress and essentially suffering, he was talking about, in part, and I'm postulating this, he was talking about the way that we can get stuck in the threat system, hatred, and the way that we can get stuck in the drive system, greed. And then delusion is that just really being lost in that hall of mirrors that is our thinking mind, and not dropping into the present to get informed about what's going on here. So the Buddha observed this almost 2,600 years ago, and began to cultivate remedies that he taught for how to alleviate the ways in which we exacerbate our suffering. It's not that we're going to get rid of lions, and it's not that we're going to get rid of the threat system. It's that we can learn when we're safe to know we're safe and rest and experience the peace and connection and generosity and compassion that is available to us when we're not lost in loops around particularly our threat system. So as you know, he spoke about the four foundations of mindfulness as absolutely central. Let's see if I can just read you this. I know many of you know this well, but these teachings bear repetition. So this is his comment, the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness, just the first part of it. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasadama. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, and bhikkhus is a word that we can translate as practitioners. Bhikkhus, venerable sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. What are the four? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful. A practitioner abides, contemplates feeling tones as feeling tones, ardent, fully aware, and mindful. And abides contemplating mind, or citta, which really means mind and emotion, minds and hearts, ardent, fully aware, and mindful. And abides contemplating the teachings, the dhammas, ardent, fully aware, and mindful. And then it goes on to speak some more about how this is the direct path for the freedom from sorrow and lamentation. And what are these instructions telling us? Well, if we begin with mindfulness of body, and it's really telling us come into the present moment, because that's where the body always is. There's only one thing going on here that isn't in the present moment, and it's the thinking mind, this new brain we cultivated. That's such a friggin' miracle, and also such a pain. This guy goes into past and future and imagination and gets lost, and everything else is constantly in the ever-present now. So when we come into the body, we're here. And With the kind of reactivity and difficulty, the second of the four noble truths, the first noble truth there is suffering. Second noble truth, suffering is caused by clinging. And one way to describe clinging is reactivity, a non-acceptance, of trying to control reality. It's that getting lost in trying to manage pain, loss and confusion with our threatened drive systems, with hatred and greed and delusion. So when we drop into the body, we get a little breath, a little pause, a little break from this sort of looping of the drive system and the threat system, and we're just here. And when we're just here, we can feel what's unpleasant, including the arising of unpleasant emotions, pain in the body, and just be with that. And so that was the first foundation, mindfulness of body. And just so interesting, fast forward to present day and what neuroscience is doing, particularly just in the last 10, 15 years. What neuroscience is showing is that indeed, when we're mindful of the body, even with very difficult chronic states like depression and anxiety, and certainly with the fear and grief that can be up at any time in life for all the challenges that we face, and particularly now with all that we see and deal with in the world, we bring mindfulness to it, and that's all. We're not even talking yet about compassion and resourcing with joy and sangha and all the other beautiful things we have. Just plain old feel it in the body. What current neuroscience says is, indeed, Name it to tame it, feel it to heal it. Just present with what is right now. Not changing the fact that it's unpleasant, but, oh, wait, this is anxiety. And where is it in the body? Oh, for me, it's an unpleasant vibration right around here. And that's all. That's mindful of body. And that's all we're doing. And a neuroscientist, and that's the Buddha said, do that. And then neuroscientists are putting people in fMRIs and saying, name your difficult feeling, find it in your body. And lo and behold, the activity in the amygdala significantly decreases when we just feel it in the body. And I'm sure there are many theories about why that's the case. I would say one is we're interrupting the looping of the thinking mind when we're present. That's one thing. And it also, it just turns out that we can tolerate, there's a lot we need to move in and out with, and the Buddha did teach wise distraction and titrating and so forth. And we can learn to tolerate and be with and turn toward compassionately difficult emotions rather than be frightened of them and pushing them away. Okay, so that's a little bit of talking about mindfulness of body. His second foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of vedana, feeling tone. And he's only talking about four things that he wants us to be mindful of: the body, feeling tone, thoughts and emotions, and the teaching. So body, thoughts and emotions, and teachings make sense. What in the heck is the second one, mindfulness of feeling tone, doing there? And why is it second after body? What is going on? And many of you know this, and this is why I was referring to dependent origination. What's going on is, when we can notice that all phenomena, so everything you see, hear, smell, taste, and touch in the present moment, and everything you think and feel internally, all phenomena has, when we look for it, we can find a feeling tone. It's either pleasant, or it's unpleasant, or it's neutral. Neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And that precedes any reactivity. It's just like, oh, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, this is neutral. We don't usually look for it. We know it, just like you can kind of know breathing but not usually be conscious of it. You know it's there. Feeling tone's the same way. You know it's there, but we've never been instructed to look for that. It's not been part of our fifth grade curriculum. So we look now, the Buddha said, check this out, folks. All phenomena has a feeling tone. And when you bring mindfulness to that, you have created a disruption to the domino effect of the looping thinking going back into fight, flight, freeze, back into craving, back into delusion. So what he noticed was when pleasant phenomena arises, you know, delicious food, wonderful friends, beautiful sunset, fabulous, cozy blanket, all the different things we love. When that arises, uninterrupted, what happens to the thinking mind, where it goes, it evolved to do this, right? It evolved to seek resources, what supports us. So it's trying to do its job. What happens when it's not disrupted by present moment awareness is we go to craving, to clinging, to wanting more. Ooh, I want that blanket again. I wonder if that little sunshine spot will be there in my garden tomorrow. Oh, that is the most tasty dessert. I'm going to order more. And that's not a problem until it is. It's not a problem. It's a beautiful thing to seek pleasant and to enjoy it and savor it. It's a good thing until it's not. And we know when it's not. We know when it becomes a sort of a desperate craving, an addiction. And we can also see out there when the acquisitional urge becomes not caring about other people's needs and not caring about the needs of the earth because I want more. we see how that acquisitional, the drive system out of whack becomes a serious source of suffering, which is the Buddha's teaching. So that's what happens with pleasant. Something pleasant arises and we move to grasp. And with mindfulness, we can know something's pleasant and just sit back and savor it. And rather than clinging and grasping, we can experience gratitude, which is a beautiful quality, a beautiful emotion. It's basically an honoring of the universe for all the incredible, beautiful things we're given all the time. Gratitude is like, thank you. Thank you for this beautiful sanctuary. Thank you for dinner. Unpleasant, undisrupted, activates the threat system. So I've hurt my shoulder. I've pulled a muscle in my shoulder. Uninterrupted, that could become like a contracting around, oh my God, such terrible timing. I have to work this week, and how am I going to exercise? And I'm so frustrated, and why did I do that? And what kind of an idiot am I? And plus that other person that did that other thing, and how come I inherited these genes that have these weak shoulders? And we've totally re-engaged that aversive system. It's just fight, flight, and flight turned inward on ourselves, which has also been studied. The inner critic, that's fight, flight, and freeze turned inward. Some aspect of what we identify as self has activated the threat system. But when we disrupt with mindfulness, and I'm here with unpleasant sensation, and just present and being with that non-judgmental turning toward that is mindfulness. I'm here. It's not fun. It's not pleasant. But in the same way that pleasant Vedana can lead to gratitude rather than to clinging and craving, unpleasant Vedana, when we turn toward it with mindfulness and we've not moved right into aversion, can lead to compassion. And compassion is really got two qualities to it. It's the willingness to turn toward suffering and the desire to alleviate it. But that desire to alleviate the suffering, you could say that about aversion too. Aversion's trying to help us too. It's another strategy that's wanting to alleviate suffering. But it's the strategy of hate. Compassion also wants to alleviate suffering, but it's the strategy of love. Okay, I can see that getting into a fit about, all the things that are going to be messed up for me this week because of my shoulder, that's not going to help. How about I bring a hand to the pain? How about I take some deep breaths? How about I get a hot compress and then a cold ice on it? How about I call my health practitioner? Love, compassion, tending, presence, which is a skillful response to unpleasant feeling tone. And sometimes compassion can be all those tender things. At other times, the unpleasant is arising, and what's called for is courage and fierceness. And courage and fierceness are also aspects of compassion. We sometimes think courage and fierceness land in the aversion camp, but they don't. Aversion is a not liking, a pushing away from a place of not liking. Courage comes from a place of love. I love this planet. I love the beings on this planet. And that kind of motivation for action is sustainable and empowering. When we're taking action, courageous action based on our hate, it's not that we are not, it's not that our hate is ill-placed. Our hate is telling us we're discerning something. We have the threat system here for a reason. It's just that it's not meant for long-term action. It's meant to let us know something's wrong. So let the hate give us its news. And then tend the reactivity and use our courage rooted in compassion. And then, okay, so we talked about how the Buddha's like telling us, bring mindfulness to pleasant and unpleasant before they turn into reactivity, which doesn't mean that it's not equally valuable to bring mindfulness to our reactivity. It is. And in the third foundation of mindfulness, he talks about mind and emotion. If you're filled with rage, be aware, I am filled with rage. It's like the mindfulness of emotion in the body. And when we can be just practice with noticing pleasant, noticing unpleasant, and noticing neutral, which I'll talk about next, we've intercepted at a really early stage before all the dominoes go, and there's a potential there to activate peace in ourselves and clarity of mind early on. And so that's why it's a powerful way to practice, just like working with pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. But it's so apparently boring that we don't do it. It's like more interesting to sit here and feel our body sitting on the chair and the breath rising and falling than to go, okay, neutral, 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 unpleasant, unpleasant, pleasant, pleasant. It's a boring kind of a practice. But the payoff is incredible. Because when you find yourself being able to notice the feeling tone of something, you see what happens. You get to see for yourself in real time why the Buddha prioritized this. So then the third one is neutral. And neutral is just all the stuff, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, that arises in life. It's the main percentage of what arises. There's the drama of pleasant and unpleasant that calls our attention, and then everything else lands in the land of neutral. And because it's not dramatic, our minds tend to ignore it, just like not see it. So, you know, like with breath or with the soles of our feet, we might just go through a whole lifetime and never notice it because it wasn't that interesting. What we lose, you know, we can see, okay, with pleasant, when we go to craving, there's the suffering that comes from that. And when it's unpleasant, we go to aversion, and there's the suffering that comes from that. The suffering that comes from ignoring the neutral is missing most of life's miracles. You might have heard of the Mary Oliver poem, Mindful, where she just talks about how amazing it is to be mindful because it's just the ordinary mundane things that come to view. And she ends that poem by saying, with mindfulness, we can notice the prayers that are made out of grass. And it's true, you turn your attention to a blade of grass, focus in, spend some time with a blade of grass, and then a miracle becomes apparent. And our lives are enriched by being present for everything we've been calling neutral. And so instead of ignoring, so if with pleasant, instead of grasping, we go to gratitude, and with unpleasant, instead of aversion, we go to compassion. And with neutral, instead of ignoring, we go to curiosity. What the heck is this thing? You know, how is it that I was gifted with two of them and they're doing all this amazing stuff for me every day? And that curiosity, that interest, deeply enriches our sense of well-being and our sense, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, that we are loved by the whole cosmos. We begin to see it for ourselves. And then in terms of those three systems of emotions, like the threat system, the drive system, and the soothe system, when we're approaching pleasant phenomena with gratitude, unpleasant phenomena with compassion, and neutral phenomena with curiosity and interest, we are de facto moving ourselves into the soothing system. This place where, rather than having our whole attention hijacked by these emotions of threat or drive, we're open. When they study people in the soothe system, their eyesight takes in more of peripheral vision. And our hearts open. And we have more access to our creative selves. Generosity is a no-brainer from the soothe system, because it's apparent that we're all one family. I want to read you a story from Pema Chodron. This is from her fantastic, brief, and highly recommended book, When Things Fall Apart, Hard Advice for Difficult Times. This is a parable. Once there was a young warrior. Her teacher told her that she had to do battle with fear. She didn't want to do that. It seemed too aggressive. It was scary. It seemed unfriendly. But the teacher said she had to do it and gave her the instructions for the battle. The day arrived. The student warrior stood on one side and fear stood on the other. The warrior was feeling very small, and fear was looking big and wrathful. They both had their weapons. The young warrior roused herself and went toward fear, prostrated 3 times, and asked, "May I have permission to go into battle with you?" Fear said, "Thank you for showing me so much respect that you ask permission." Then the young warrior said, "How can I defeat you?" Fear replied, "My weapons are that I talk fast and I get very close to your face. Then you get completely unnerved and you do whatever I say. If you don't do what I tell you, I have no power. You can listen to me and you can have respect for me. You can even be convinced by me. But if you don't do what I say, I have no power." In that way, the student warrior learned how to defeat fear. Unpleasant arises, well, any of them arise, but in this case, unpleasant arises in the form of fear, and the warrior is instructed, turn toward it with respect, non-judgmentally. Turn toward it with respect. This doesn't mean that the unpleasant phenomena is going to go away immediately. What it means is that once you've taken that seat of the compassionate witness, you're no longer confused by, identified with, feeling in obligation to this energy and its instructions for action. We can walk alongside these difficult energies and know they're there, handle them with respect, say thank you, I know, thank you for sharing, I know you're trying to help me, you're part of my threat system, part of my system to try to protect me, I get it. Right now in this moment, we're safe, and we're going to move forward. Georgia O'Keeffe had a quote, "I've been terrified every day of my life, and I never let it stop me from doing a single thing I wanted to do." Our emotions are here to stay. The way that our thoughts loop in and reactivate them is not something we're going to change overnight. And we have been so profoundly gifted with these teachings and their suggestions, pragmatic suggestions for how to alleviate our suffering, including this suggestion: notice pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral phenomena as they arise and turn toward them with presence. And then we move ourselves into more peace. So thank you for your kind attention. I have a song or two to offer, but before that, I want to ask if you have any questions or even just thoughts about how this is landing for you tonight. Yeah, very welcome, and would love to hear your voice. Yes.
I just want to say thank you. That was fabulous. And I was listening to some talks. One was a health-related talk, and one was a Dharma talk today at Tarabana. And the reason one of the reasons I'm sitting here smiling so much is that two different domains talking about the same thing, and then I come here, and you have a whole other way of talking about the same thing and helping me to hopefully embed that.
Wonderful.
And to be reminded in another way that I can maybe cling to more easily, clinging in the good sense.
Yeah. Thank you. People online, did you hear that? No. And what's your name?
Deborah.
This is Deborah saying that today she had been listening to a couple of other teachings, including one from Tara Brach, that are resonant with, parallel to what I've been sharing tonight, and that sense of gratitude for kind of getting it in all different forms so that we can really internalize and integrate these teachings, which is really the trick.
Hopefully.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting that the word in Pali for mindfulness is sati, which the literal translation is remember, because it feels like that's really the thing, is we hear these teachings, but can we remember them in the moment? That's the hardest part. Yeah. That's great. So Deb is saying that years ago on a retreat with Irina Weissman and Eric Colvid, she was in an interview with Irina, who said, remembering is the core of the practice.
Words to that effect,
yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, two questions.
Great. Nancy.
This isn't a question, but I just want to say that I love the name it to tame it and feel it to heal it. I've been a psychotherapist for a long time, and it completely jives with my experience of working with people in a therapeutic way. So I'm going to borrow that. I really
do. Those are not my phrases. They literally come. Where I learned name it to tame it and feel it to heal it was in a teacher training for mindful self-compassion. But it doesn't come from that either. It comes from some therapists. So yeah, but they're little pith sayings to convey the neuroscience. So I'm glad that worked for you. Did you all hear that? Okay, great. Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you.
Isabel.
Yeah, hi, Eve. I loved your talk. Hi.
Thank you.
It was just so great. You just have a way with words that goes right in.
Oh,
I love it. I think that the core part of what you said that really struck me was that you can see it, that the guy, the fear told the warrior, you can see it, you can feel it, but just don't do what I tell you to do. And that is so cool. That's like something to really hold on to and remember.
Yeah.
Just quote. It's like, yeah, just remember, it's going to be there. It's going to be in your body. You're going to feel it, but you don't have to react to it. And at least for me, that's what really struck out from that story. And that's what I'm taking away with me anyway.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's a powerful story. And that message about the unpleasant can be there, can be like, have you heard that? I'm sure you have. You know that poem by Rumi, The Guest House? This being human is a guest house, each day a new arrival. And, I can't remember. Even if it's a crowd of sorrows who sweep you from your furniture, still greet it at the door, laughing, which is a high bar, excuse me. But the point being, we can have these experiences, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and just welcome them and then let them go when they go. And that's the direction we're headed with these teachings. Yeah, Mary.
Mary, could you come a little closer? So please.
Thank you. I had a gratitude practice now for many years. And what I have found is that it started with an article about radical gratitude. And now what I notice is that when I'm being mindful and I'm aware that the situations that are neither dramatically pleasant or dramatically unpleasant, that there is a certain sweetness to them.
Yeah.
And it's not, it could just be when I'm walking and it's hot and I hate being hot. People who know me know I hate being hot. And there's a cool breeze. Just that little bit of cool breeze on my skin. It's like just gratitude wells mm-hmm. up. And I have found that my gratitude practice has really helped me notice those non-dramatic, almost neutral moments and realize that there is such sweetness. And you're right. I think that what you said, Eve, is that so much of our life is like we're on automatic pilot because it's not that interesting. Mm-hmm. And curiosity or just being there is so, man, it's so helpful.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your talk today.
Thank you for saying that. That's very well said. Yeah. Yeah, there's all these beautiful little moments of grace, I'm going to say. And you know, something interesting, the Latin source word for gratitude is gratias, and that's also the source word for grace. So that turning toward with curiosity and gratitude, we can see these beautiful, blessed little moments like the cool breeze. Yeah. And we're nurtured by that. Here's another fascinating thing. In the Buddha's teachings, when we get compassion fatigue, we've been turning toward the difficult a lot, and we get compassion fatigue. The teaching is not, in that moment, to push through with compassion. The teaching is to resource yourself with joy. And that's why joy shows up all over the Buddha's teachings. It's one of the divine abodes of the heart. It's one of the seven factors of enlightenment. And it shows up all over the place as an essential quality for concentration. Joy is a must. And in our culture, we're used to striving. We're used to valuing productivity. And we love joy when we get it, but we tend to put it to the bottom of our to-do list. When in fact, it's the fuel that refills us. We need it. We need it. So that mindful of neutral can give us access to more joy. Yeah. Okay, any other thoughts? Sharings? How is this landing for you? All right. So Mary forwarded me an email from Liz requesting my song, The Gardener, which I'm happy to do now before we close. This song I wrote, I was, it was the 90s. So you may recall that we were still having phones with windy cords until like 2005. And we didn't have GPS. I don't know when the GPSs came in, but not in the 90s. We were still opening up maps by the side of the road. And so I was in a feminist folk trio, And we were doing a tour of the East Coast during the winter months. And we had a van, and I had dropped off my two bandmates at different families' houses, and I was driving to my cousin's house, and I got lost. So I was on the road for several hours with my maps, drove through several states, which you can do in the East Coast in a few hours. And I had one cassette tape in the car because one of my bandmates had taken the little box of cassette tapes. I had one cassette tape, and it was Thich Nhat Hanh talking about how the mind is like a garden. And we can, basically his teaching on wise effort, we can notice and gently respect and not act from unbeneficial mind states. And we can cultivate and develop and maintain beneficial mind states. And beneficial mind states, really, again, are all those mind states that put us in a state of peace ourselves and then offer peace to others. So contentment, generosity, truthfulness, all the things. Loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, all the things. Cultivate those. But the Buddha said that the greatest of all of the qualities is patience. And I'm so glad he said that because I don't know about you, but I can't just decide I'm going to be equanimous and then that's how I am for the rest of my life. The habit patterns, they dig deep roots. They really are like the most determined weeds. They just come up over and over for decades. So hanging in there with these practices. Let me make sure. Yeah. It's really hard not to go where my whims urge me to go, but I know what sort of person I'm longing to become. If I want to help anybody in the world before I die, if I want the suffering all around us to subside, I have got to be more conscious of the things I do and don't do. Every little seed in time will flower. Plant the ones that lead me down a path toward really helping. I am the garden, but I'm also the gardener. Choices for the future are made now. Certain habits, deeply rooted, flourish in the heart of me. Repetition, like the seasons, comes naturally. Some of it's good, some of it's not. Right now, this is all I've got, but it doesn't mean. The homeless man. It's about perceiving what's happening in this very moment and deliberately choosing to extend love. It's really hard not to go where my whims urge me to go, but I know what sort of person I'm longing. If I want to help anybody in the world before after being lost with that cassette tape playing over and over with Thich Nhat Hanh, I got to my cousin's house and wrote that song like with him that same evening, the day before Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
That's how that song came to be.